What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
A longtime U.S. ally in Latin America is not very happy with Washington at the moment.
I think Colombia is quite upset at how it's been treated by the Donald Trump administration.
How the U.S.-Colombia relationship is deteriorating. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, why experts are worried about the next cutting-edge AI technologies.
We have a choice. We can either build machines, robots, and other intelligent systems that are tools for us, that help us, empower us, or we can build robots and other systems which just directly compete with us.
We'll also hear what made Celia Cruz, the queen of salsa, so special.
It was brain and soul and movement at the same time.
Plus, a one-man show where comedy meets mental health, today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. Thank you for being with us today. The United States and Colombia have developed a close relationship over the years, but it is under strain right now.
The government in Colombia just recalled its ambassador from Washington. President Gustavo Petro has accused the U.S. military of killing a Colombian citizen in the Caribbean. The Trump administration says it's using deadly force against terrorists and drug traffickers there. And President Donald Trump has made no secret of his disdain for Petro, calling Colombia's president a, quote, illegal drug dealer, among other things.
He's a lunatic who's got a lot of problems, mental problems.
Sergio Guzman is the director of Colombia Risk Analysis in Bogota. I spoke with him earlier today about this new state of relations between the U.S. and Colombia.
I think Colombia is quite upset at how it's been treated by the Donald Trump administration. And the Petro administration is trying to send a message saying this kind of language is intolerable. You cannot refer to the Colombian president as the leader of a drug organization. You cannot make these kinds of assertions without backing them up with evidence, which is true. But the Trump administration wants to throw around how it's pressing down the thumb on Colombia and Petro. And in a way, it's throwing by wayside close to 40 years of bilateral cooperation.
Yeah, I want to get to that history a bit more in just a second. But this spat, does it seem like it is more than just a temporary spat between these longtime allies, or is it something bigger than that?
I think this is because the presidents don't see along eye to eye. They're not necessarily aligned ideologically, and they actually see the other as an antagonist and a worthy opponent.
Let's talk about the stakes of this squabbling among leaders. President Trump has decided to slash aid to Colombia. Here is some of what he said about that.
They don't have a fight against drugs. They make drugs. They refine drugs. They make cocaine. They have cocaine factories. They have no fight against drugs. And I'm stopping all payments to Colombia because they don't have anything to do with their fight against drugs.
How much aid money are we talking that the U.S. has historically supplied to Colombia, and what was that aid used for?
Over the past two decades, Colombia has received close to $15 billion U.S. dollars in assistance. That, on a yearly basis, is around $400 million. Part of it goes to social and development funds. Part of it goes to military assistance in the fight against drugs.
Right. The U.S. and Colombia, our formal allies, have long been working together on this so-called war on drugs. Tell me more about how important this relationship is.
It's central. Colombia is the number one producer of cocaine globally. Close to 90% of all cocaine that that the U.S. gets is from Colombia. And the United States government has for decades been involved in trying to fight counter-narcotics in Colombia, first through shared intelligence and work to kill Pablo Escobar back in the 90s. Now, that has not necessarily always been on the sunny side. In 1994, the U.S. decertified Colombia and withdrew the visa from President Ernesto Samper because his campaign had allegedly received money from drug traffickers. Then that relationship was restored in 1998 when President Andrés Pastrana took office and was strengthened further in 2002 when President Álvaro Uribe took office and began waging a war on narco-terrorism. That is when this term was etched, so to speak. President Duque, who took office in 2018, had a tense relationship with Donald Trump because then, in his first term, President Trump had said that Colombia had not been able to curb the flow of drugs. So this is something of a pickle that Donald Trump has been carrying throughout his term as president of the United States. Now he sees an enemy in President Petro who comes from a very different ideological end of the spectrum, the far left.
So how are people seeing this in Colombia?
Well, I think people are looking at this with sort of indignation, right? Because Colombia has been a very strong partner to the United States. We obviously understand the animosity between Petro and Trump, but we also feel that Trump may be punishing Colombia for a personal fight with Petro. And I think to that effect, many Colombian politicians, many business leaders have been to Washington to explain that our problem is not country to country, but it is a personal problem between the presidents, and the bilateral relationship ought to be sustained despite this hiccup that we seem to be going through.
So what needs to happen here to ratchet down these new tensions between the U.S. and Colombia?
Well, unfortunately, while Petro still has 10 months in office, we don't see that a de-escalation will take place because Petro is very intent on making Trump a central linchpin of the 2026 presidential election. And so although there is a movement by Colombian politicians, Colombian mayors, Colombian governors to travel to the United States to explain this, both sort of figureheads have this very short-term advantage in keeping the fight hot.
So you're saying that Petro is unlikely to try to de-escalate things so that he can continue to make this an election issue up until the 2026 election?
That's correct. And I think also Trump is also taking advantage of the fact that there is a willing and ready leader to fight with him, that he can prove that the U.S. is respected, that the U.S. is taken seriously, all these manifested objectives that he's had before. And in Petro, he sees a perfect opportunity to show how he means to do business.
Sergio Guzman is the director of Colombia Risk Analysis in Bogota.
A former British soldier on trial for killing two people on Bloody Sunday in Northern Ireland back in 1972 has been cleared of all charges. A witness from that day, who was a 15-year-old student at the time, spoke with us 2 weeks ago as the trial in Belfast was just beginning. His name is Don Mullen, and he shared some of the details he still remembers from more than 50 years ago.
The sound of Michael Kelly as the bullet hit him. And he fell to the ground, and then a bullet hit above my head. And I remember the wall bursting and bits of fragments of mortar and bricks, they came around us. And at which point I realized this is danger, I've got to get away.
Mullen did get away to safety, but a total of 13 people died that day, including 17-year-old Michael Kelly. We reached Don Mullen again today to get his reaction to that not guilty verdict for the man on trial. He was referred to in court only as Soldier F.
After I heard the verdict, I called John Kelly, who's the brother of Michael Kelly. And he says, yeah, Don, he says, we're disappointed, but we're not surprised. I'm just sad for the families, you know. I mean, I don't think he would have spent very long behind bars, but I think it was just the principle. We know that he killed more than the two people that he was being tried for. As the family said, you know, like, a victory for one family was a victory for them all. But they've been denied that now, you know.
During the trial in Belfast, the former British paratrooper did not testify in his own defense. In fact, he sat hidden behind a blue curtain during the proceedings to protect his identity. Outside the building, Paul Young, who's with a group called the Northern Ireland Veterans Movement, spoke in defense of the British military's actions during the era known as the Troubles.
veterans across the whole of the United Kingdom that served in Northern Ireland with honour and courage will be heartened by this verdict today. You can hear the barracking that I'm getting from people behind me. That shows the good grace they do not have.
In his decision today, the judge in the Bloody Sunday trial said there was not enough evidence to convict Soldier F. But he added that unarmed, innocent people were killed on that day and that the British soldiers who were involved, quote, should hang their heads in shame.
Across nearly every sport, athletes dream of competing at the Olympics. To get there, they usually have to prove that they're one of the best in the country they represent. But even that doesn't always guarantee a spot on the roster. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on one such case in basketball.
Nneka Ogwumike has been recognized as one of the best basketball players in the best league in the world ever since she stepped on the scene.
With the first pick in the 2012 WNBA draft, Los Angeles Sparks select Demkadi Ogwumike from Stanford University.
From being the number one draft pick to Rookie of the Year, Ogwumike entered the WNBA in 2012 and quickly took charge. By 2016, she was the league's MVP and scored the winning shot in the championship game.
Ogwumike denied, another chance, it's good! Nneka Ogwumike puts it home with 3.1 to go!
The 6'2" forward, who recently finished her 14th professional season, still shines on the court. She's done just about everything a pro basketball player can do, except play at the Olympics. Ogwumike, born in the States, played with Team USA in qualifying games for the Olympics, but kept getting left off the roster when it came time to name the final team. In 2021, her coach, Derek Fisher, expressed real disappointment that she wasn't picked for the Tokyo Games.
To think that she might go through her career and never play for Team USA in the Olympics is a freaking travesty.
But apart from Team USA, Ogwumike had another option. Her parents immigrated from Nigeria in the 1980s, and she is a dual citizen. So Ogwumike asked FIBA, the sport's global governing body, if she could switch national eligibility and represent Nigeria. USA Basketball supported the move, and then head coach Don Staley was behind it too.
I hope FIBA allows her to play, because of what she's given to the game, how hard she's worked for it, and I hope she's able to check off being an Olympian.
But now, all options have hit a dead end after a ruling from FIBA came down last week.
FIBA has denied Nneka Ogwumike's application to compete for Nigeria at next year's World Cup and the 2028 LA Olympics.
Former Nigerian national team player Roz Goldonwode reacted to the news on her podcast, Good Follow.
It feels very unfortunate, very arbitrary, very punitive in the way that Nneka is being handled. What's happening is an individual is really being hurt by this and denied an opportunity that she really deserves.
This recent rejection is the third time that FIBA has denied Ogwumike's request to play for Nigeria. The 35-year-old told the Associated Press that she's not likely to give it another go. FIBA has not said exactly why Ogwumike can't play for Nigeria, and the association declined an interview request for this story. But Mfan Udoka, a former player and assistant coach for Nigeria's women's team, has an idea.
I think the nail in the coffin was just the fact that, you know, she's played in major competitions for the USA.
Udoka is referring to international basketball rules that say players are not allowed to switch from one national team to another after their 17th birthday. By the way, that's more strict than other sports. FIBA's rules say there can be exceptions, and a player can switch to a different country if it benefits basketball's development there. Some people say, of course, a player like Ogwumike would give Nigeria's team a boost, but in the grand scheme of things, Udoka doesn't think so.
It would have probably helped, obviously, from a competitive standpoint when we're playing other countries. I mean, she gives us a better chance to win and maybe medal. But as far as the local basketball goes and the federation on ground in Nigeria, no, I don't think it would have done anything.
Ogumike's own Olympic dream is over, but she hopes her eligibility struggles will help the next generation of dual citizenship basketball players decide which country they want to represent. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Up next, new calls to rein in the development of artificial superintelligence, why experts see it as an existential threat to humanity, and what can be done. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. There is no shortage of doomsday scenarios out there involving artificial intelligence. The warnings could all be boiled down to this: AI is an existential threat to human life. Some have called the warnings alarmist, but this week another red alert emerged from several Nobel laureates and big-name celebrities who say the threat is real. They signed on to a statement calling specifically for super-intelligent AI systems, or ASIs, to be banned until experts reach a consensus that the technology can be developed safely. Max Tegmark is the head of the Future of Life Institute. He's also a professor at MIT doing research on AI. We started by talking about just what artificial superintelligence is.
What underlies all this is this idea that's driven all the progress in AI, that really intelligence is all about information processing. And even though our brain is very good at it, it is fundamentally a biological computer, and it's clearly possible to build other kinds of computers that are just vastly smarter than us in every way. That's what artificial superintelligence is.
So, I mean, it is a quantum leap beyond AI itself, correct?
Yeah, today's AI is already better than us at speaking 200 languages and extremely good at math. And in the last 4 years, it's gotten very good at reading and writing. But it is still way below human level in certain other tasks. Depending on who you ask, they think it's going to take 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. I'm very humble about how long it's going to take, but people have kind of stopped saying it's going to take 100 years or 50 years. Almost all of the leaders in the field think it's going to happen in our lifetime.
So we may have qualms about ChatGPT and its cousins. We might be critical of it, but I don't think many of us are at the level of being afraid of it. What makes super intelligence not just problematic, but threatening in a very literal way?
Because intelligence gives power. If you go down to the zoo and you ask yourself, who's in the cages? Is it the humans or the tigers? You know, the answer obviously is that the smarter species put the less smart one in the cages. We dominate Earth, right? We dominate the tigers and everyone else, not because we're stronger, but because we're smarter. We were smarter than the Neanderthals. That's why things didn't go so well for them. So Alan Turing, the godfather of our field, picked up on this in 1951 and said that if we ever build a new species of superintelligent robots, the default outcome is they are in charge, which raises the question, why would we do that then, right? When most people instead want the AI tools that by definition we can control, tools that cure cancer, tools that eliminate traffic accidents. But nonetheless, that's not what these companies are talking about.
What are they talking about?
They're talking about superintelligence, that they actually want to build this effectively new, smarter species. A lot of people don't like that. And the decision to bring in a new, smarter species to Earth, which is sort of equivalent of letting us get invaded by aliens from space or a superior in their tech, right? It's not something that should be left to just a bunch of unelected tech nerds in San Francisco who've been drinking too much Red Bull. This is something everybody needs to have a say in.
As to the tech companies, the big tech companies, why would they want to do this? Why would they want to give the smarts away to artificial superintelligence?
It's a really good question. You should ask them, of course.
Why do you think?
What they usually tell me is when I talk, I've known all of these CEOs privately for many years, and they'll usually privately say to me things like, it's kind of inevitable that this is going to happen, and it's just so dangerous that only I can do it safely. I have to do it.
You mentioned just the diversity of people who have signed this letter. I mean, we also see Barack Obama and Richard Branson, former Irish President Mary Robinson. all concerned that ASI could displace jobs, pose ethical risks, etc. How could it actually become uncontrollable, though? Can you walk us through an explanation for how that happens or what it might look like?
It's pretty obvious that if, from the perspective of a lion, you know, humans are uncontrollable. There's nothing they can do to prevent us from ultimately putting them in cages or hunting them, right? Because we're just so much smarter than them. The lions can't predict exactly how we're going to trick them, or they don't even understand how a rifle works, right? But that doesn't prevent us from dominating the lions. If you're the North American black rhino, you know, wondering how could these weird little things with two legs and two arms drive us to extinction when we're stronger than them, they wouldn't understand it. But we did actually drive them to extinction within the last few decades, right? So I think the catch here is to not think of superintelligence as just a new technology like the internet, but to actually think of it as a new robot species. Regardless of whether we're extinct or not, you know, when I play with my two-year-old son, I want him to have a meaningful future, even if he doesn't get driven extinct. I don't want him to be economically obsolete. And I think this is the key reason why we see such a diversity of signatories. You know, a lot of faith leaders feel that human dignity is really important. We have a choice. We can either build machines, robots, and other intelligent systems that are tools for us, that help us, empower us, or we can build robots and other systems which just directly compete with us, you know.
If superintelligence gets out of hand, could humans just pull the plug on it?
No. It's just like if an alien space fleet comes and invades us, or even if someone is firing a heat-seeking missile at your airplane, right, it has AI in it. Would you feel, I'm just going to unplug the heat-seeking missile? No, of course not.
I'm speaking with Max Tegmark, a professor at MIT who studies AI. Back to this, you know, notion that a lot of big companies like Meta are chasing artificial superintelligence. Do they have an argument for why we need this technology?
Sam Altman, for example, the CEO of the world's most powerful AI company, he wrote this article saying that his vision for what should happen is we should merge with machines. But, you know, when I play with my two-year-old son, Leo, I don't like the idea that some tech bro in San Francisco decides that my son is going to merge with machines. What if he doesn't want that? You know, what if my wife and I don't want that? This is an incredibly radical thing to just force on us all undemocratically.
I mean, if artificial superintelligence could soon be able to outthink, outplan, and outmaneuver any human-made safeguards, is more regulation and oversight even possible at this point?
Well, of course, because we don't have superintelligence yet, even though we're getting closer. This is the perfect time to put these safeguards in place. You might think it's inevitable that any tech that can give a lot of profit and power will be built, but that's obviously not true if you look at historical fact. If I could do human cloning on you and make a million clones of you and also tweak your DNA so that you were even better at some stuff, can you imagine how much money I could make off of that, right? Yet, after a lot of discussion in the 70s, scientists and the general public just concluded that this was just disgusting. This is something that could cause us to lose control over our species. We just didn't want it. It got super stigmatized and eventually banned. And how many human clones have you met on the street today, right? Zero, right? We've stopped a lot of very profitable tech before. We can do it again.
Max Tegmark is a professor at MIT and the head of the Future of Life Institute, which organized a statement warning about the dangers of artificial superintelligence.
More global stories are coming your way. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Catching a flight out of Singapore is about to get a little more expensive. The city-state in Southeast Asia is introducing a new levy on all departing flights in order to generate funding for alternatives to jet fuel. Advocates are actually split on whether the move is really an effective way to make air travel more environmentally friendly. That is the focus of today's Big Fix, our series on climate change solutions. The World's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, has more.
Aviation is booming in Singapore. Earlier this year, the country's main airport reported an all-time yearly record of passengers. In a speech before Singapore's parliament, Senior Transport Minister Sun Shui Ling said that's cause for celebration.
Aviation is a critical sector for Singapore. It connects us to the world and anchors our status as a global hub.
But Shui Ling says the industry needs to grow sustainably. Jet fuel is a huge driver of climate change, up to 4% of human-caused CO2 emissions. That's why she pushed for this new legislation that will help fund the adoption of sustainable aviation fuels, or SAFs, which can be used in the exact same way as traditional jet fuel.
SAF is the most practical way to decarbonize aviation today. It is a drop-in fuel that can be blended with jet fuel for use with existing aircraft and refueling infrastructure, without the need for costly modifications.
Sustainable aviation fuel is a broad term encompassing everything that isn't petroleum. It's expensive, up to 5 times more costly than regular fuel. And this measure, which passed the full parliament, aims to help cover the cost by putting in place a fixed levy on all flights. Passengers are expected to see ticket prices jump by $3 to $16, a source of some pushback in parliament. But according to Camille Mitrell, a sustainable fuel expert at the nonprofit Transport and Environment, it makes sense.
It's fair that passengers pay for it rather than taxpayers, you know, because at least you're targeting the uses of aviation. And also we're talking about a few dollars per ticket. So it's a small price for cleaner flying.
Mitrell says sustainable fuels are the clearest path towards decarbonizing aviation. So anything that encourages their adoption is a win. But she does have some reservations about Singapore's new levy.
It's an important step, but if it funds the wrong kind of fuels, then it just risks polishing aviation's image more than its climate record. So this could be a model for others, but to me, only if it supports truly sustainable fuels.
Sustainable aviation fuels include pricey synthetic fuels that are virtually emissions-free, but also biofuels that require lots of water and lead to deforestation.
They actually end up emitting more carbon than their petroleum counterparts.
That's Emily Cassidy with Project Drawdown, a nonprofit that researches science-based solutions to climate change. She's not a fan of Singapore's new policy. In fact, she's not really a fan of sustainable aviation fuels in general.
Broadly speaking, sustainable aviation fuels aren't really going to reduce emissions all that much. Airlines are only allowed to blend them in to aviation fuels a small amount. So what we're talking about here is a potentially really, really small amount of emissions reductions.
Right now, industry groups limit the amount of SAF planes can use while they test safety. Cassidy says until there's proper regulation of which fuels can be used and more buy-in from airlines, she'd like to see governments take other actions to reduce climate change, like finding ways to prevent contrails, the artificial clouds created by airplanes that can trap heat. But other advocates, like Camille Mitrell and the lawmakers in Singapore who pushed for the flight levy, say some action is better than none. And the only way the sustainable fuel industry will be able to grow and get greener in the process is with more investment. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
Mental health is a serious matter, but for Sam Kisajukian, his own bipolar disorder is also great fodder for jokes.
I love Vincent van Gogh. A lot of art historians believe that he had 5 different types of mental illnesses, and they also think that he was the greatest artist. And I think there's a correlation. I think he is the best artist because he had the most mental illnesses. So I'm really looking into how to get more. And
Kisajukian, who is Australian, is no longer just a stand-up comic. He is also a visual artist. A few years ago, he experienced a 6-month burst of manic creativity that eventually collapsed into depression. Kisajukian describes how this all played out in his stage show, 300 Paintings. It's a one-man show and art exhibit that's a meditation on mental illness and creativity, and it's currently touring in U.S. cities. The story of his stage performance starts in 2021. When he made a big change in his work and his life.
the pandemic was kind of ending as most people were coming back outside, and I was like, well, no, I'm going to go back inside. I kind of went counterculture.
Right. So you stop working as a comedian, you get evicted from your place, you crave this total isolation. And then, as you tell your audience, you find the perfect place to live for that.
It had everything I needed. It had no windows to disrupt my circadian rhythm or provide air. I had solitude. I had no neighbors. Sometimes at night I would practice. I'd go, help! And no one would come. And best of all, it used to be an old cake factory.
So you call it in the show your Willy Wonka cake factory, I think. And you say you barely left just to get supplies. You become obsessed with painting. How did you land on painting? Why did this become your obsession?
Well, I was unpacking some boxes and I found a beret, and I didn't own a beret, so I put it on. And when I saw myself in the mirror, I thought I looked like an artist. And then I thought, well, maybe I should become an artist. It made sense at the time because I think I was very tired of trying to express my ideas using words. And when I would perform on stage, I was trying to kind of show myself to people, but then it's kind of fit in this medium of comedy. So if you're not making people laugh, you're failing. And so it really kind of narrowed and crowbarred my ideas in there. And I just love this idea of being able to make stuff by myself, where almost like I could be the audience for the paintings and the paintings almost become a performer. And then I could switch hats and then I could be the audience. I could be the performer and the paintings could be the audience. And so it was like this dialogue with myself. So I kind of found a way to substitute an audience for just a painting.
So at the time, you, as we will talk about, had all this creative energy, but you didn't know exactly why.
I didn't know I had bipolar at the time. And what coincided with beginning to paint was a 6-month manic episode. Manic episodes can usually go for a few days or a few weeks. I did 6 months, so that's how you get a show.
So you did get a show out of it, and it's very funny. How did you decide on the tone you wanted to strike when talking about your manic episode?
Well, I didn't want to glorify it or vilify it. I kind of wanted to superimpose, you know, both truths, the kind of full range of what it could be. I think a lot of people usually take one stance or the other, and I've kept comedy in there, and it feels different from being a stand-up comedian, because when I was a stand-up comedian, I just want to make people laugh, and that's the end goal. But in the show, I found that comedy is really good, almost like a Trojan horse, because, you know, people can enjoy it at a kind of comedic level. And if you keep people laughing, people that perhaps are not ready to have a conversation around mental health might shut down if there was no comedy. But I find that if I can keep the enjoyment in the room, then I can feed the more difficult ideas slowly under the table.
Did you worry at all that you were too far on the side of kind of romanticizing mania by talking about your extreme creativity during this period and making it all kind of a fun joke?
You know, it definitely was a concern. One of the big things that I did is I worked with a mental health organization to just do it like almost like a safety check on the show, because the last thing I would like to do is give people, encourage them to do something like that. Like I very specifically in the show, like, you know, I don't regret that it happened. I'm very glad that it happened, but I would never want to go back there. And I'm so grateful to have the stability I have now from post-treatment. And everything I do now is to try and stay in the middle. I think the thing that I try and do is explain how there are parts of ourselves that, you know, especially with people that go through manic episodes, they often hide this part of themselves because there's like a disconnect between where they are now in a stable state and this thing that they've tried to distance themselves from. And I think it's a valid part of your history. And so what I try and do in the show is say, you know, I'm not rejecting this part of my life. It was informative. I learned a lot. And I kind of want to show people, because that's a lot of the parts that I would usually hide.
Mm. So there's a moment when this manic episode starts to turn into something else. Can you take us to that moment?
Yeah, I mean, at first it was incredibly creative. I was producing a lot of different kinds of things, and it was such a revelation to myself. I'd never experienced this part of my mind, it kind of exploding outwards. But then it just kept going. And, you know, it did get to a point towards the end of the manic episode that, you know, I really was falling apart physically. You know, I hadn't been outside. I was malnourished and, you know, months of not sleeping properly. And so I did start to move into psychosis, and it was like hallucinations, and I started walking around in the dark so I could paint them. And, Yeah, I just got to a dangerous situation and I had a fall and I hit my head. And it's very terrible that had to happen, but it scared me so much in that moment. I really did think I was going to die. And I think that's what broke the delusion and kind of made me force myself to actually go into bed and just say, this has to stop. And I just tried to sleep and stay in the bed until the mania did start to subside. And then it was short-lived because then the depressive episode started.
So eventually you seek help. You're diagnosed with bipolar. You start medication and therapy. It is an adjustment. How is your art different now than it was before, or is it different?
I think the brain's fairly plastic. The medication did affect my short-term memory, and they said that it would slow the synapses firing in my brain. I think now I don't have the same like explosion of creativity, but what I do have is stability and consistency. And so the way that I paint is I'll do 1 to 2 paintings a day and try and document my mental state of that day. And then each painting is a reaction to the previous painting, kind of both emotionally and with color. And so because I'm able to kind of paint more consistently over the year, I actually am able to go much further with the creativity and kind of build something more cohesive over time, as opposed to like doing this big explosion that I end up self-sabotaging and tearing everything down. So I'm actually very grateful, and I think I've been able to go much further now.
Mm. You say that your goal now is to be more even, right?
Yeah.
Is there ever any part of you that is tempted to, you know, allow yourself to tip into mania, to tap into this seemingly inexhaustible creativity?
I think when I was in the first 18 months of recovery, you know, I do remember how well and quick I can function, how effortless it is. And I think I just got to this point where I was so grateful that I've always tried to understand my mind. And it took 36 years before realizing that, you know, bipolar was a missing link. And so I was very grateful to have that diagnosis. And, you know, I know I can't go back there. Like, it's too dangerous to myself and my family having to be on the other side. Like, I now know the amount of, like, worry and suffering that they cause being on the other side, not knowing how to interact. And so, you know, I just kind of disconnect from it. I know if I put my head down and I just do the work, everything is very much more boring now in terms of like what it involves. It's like eating well, sleeping well, being open about communication of when I'm kind of like, am I getting a little bit manic? Okay, reduce my workload, let people know, like figure out how to get back to the middle. And so I'm just very focused on always trying to get back to the middle.
Mm. How is it for you telling this story every night on stage? I'm wondering if it feels therapeutic or if it is a challenge.
You know, at first it was therapeutic. I was only going to ever do the show once. It came up where I got asked to do a show at a Sydney Fringe Festival, and then I had done it in previous years. I dropped out, and then they called me and said, you know, why are you dropping out? And I said, look, I haven't written any comedy. I did this for the last, this thing happened, and it was very intense, and I don't know how to make sense of it. And they said, why don't you just talk about that? So the night before the show, I still hadn't written anything, and so I thought, why don't I just put all the paintings on a projector and I'll talk people through what was happening at the time versus what I actually now know was happening post-diagnosis. And I only invited people that had to deal with me when I was manic and depressed to explain to them what happened. And so that part was very therapeutic. And then as I've started to do it, I've kind of was so confused that people would even relate to something that was so specific to me. Now when I do it, I think I don't think about it, about what its effect is. I just try and show up as stable as I can every night, because I don't think the show works if I'm kind of a poor representative of what I'm trying to speak about. So I think also the show keeps me in a stable state, which is nice.
What do you want people to know about life as a person with bipolar that we haven't talked about yet?
I think that, you know, society is not set up structurally for people with mental illness or bipolar. And I think that your whole life you've had to kind of like creatively problem solve to navigate society structures. And I think that when you move to a creative medium, your creative muscle is so honed over years that, you know, you can really flourish. And I think there's so much of us that we try and hide with bipolar because you can't make sense of it. There's a divide of yourself between these depressed states and manic states. And it is very hard sometimes to feel this kind of uniform history of yourself as like one person. And so I think the one thing it gives you is it makes you such a unique person in how you kind of, you've got these three lenses. You can look at the world through a depressed state or a manic state or a stable state, and you don't need to be in a manic state to have this creativity because you've had experience there. So if you just kind of like do it from a stable place, you can still channel the viewpoints empathetically of manic and depressed. And so now you have three lenses operated from a place of stability. And I think that makes it very, very powerful to make all types of creative works.
Sam Kisajukian, thank you so much for your show and for talking to us here in studio. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Sam Kisajukian is currently touring the U.S. with his one-man show and art exhibit called 300 Paintings.
These are red crabs. Yes, many thousands of them, each about the size of a salad plate.
They're doing that creepy sideways crab walk to cross a road. This scene is playing out on Christmas Island in Australian territory in the Indian Ocean.
During early morning and during the late afternoon, they kind of en masse come out and just are marching basically slowly across the landscapes, over the roads, through gardens, all the way down to the coast.
Alexia Jankowski runs a national park on Christmas Island. In this video from the Associated Press, she explains how the red crabs travel from the island's forests to the sea each year to spawn.
They're indiscriminate. So whatever they need to go over to get to the shore, they will go over it. So if you leave your front door open, you're going to come home and have a whole bunch of red crabs in your living room.
Once they've been shooed out of the house and get to the ocean, male crabs create burrows where females lay and incubate eggs. At high tide in mid-November, the spawn will be released into the ocean in accordance with the phase of the moon.
They spend time in the ocean for a while before returning to Christmas Island as small crabs. Jankowski says that 1,200 residents there take care of the crabs on their journey to and from the sea, especially when it comes to crossing the roads.
We actually spend a lot of our time raking the busiest roads to allow cars to go through so that we don't impact crabs too much. When their baby's only about half the size of your fingernail, we can't rake them because you'd crush them. So instead we use leaf blowers.
This bright red carpet of crabs on Christmas Island is quite the sight. Part nature documentary, part horror movie, if you ask me. You can check it out at theworld.org.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The queen of salsa, the late Celia Cruz, was born 100 years ago this week. She brought the sound of Cuba to the world, even after she left the island and could never go home again. Celia Cruz built most of her career here in the United States, becoming a beloved and respected icon of Latin music. Her image is celebrated on the U.S. quarter, and her voice will still pull people onto the dance floor around the globe. But in Cuba, this centennial is mostly accompanied by silence. The World's TV's Isaiah has more.
Celia Cruz had one of those voices you couldn't mistake. Her presence on the stage was a mix of power and joy. She could turn any concert into a celebration.
She was such a force.
We asked her longtime friend and collaborator, salsa legend Rubén Blades, what made her so unique.
Well, first of all, she was one of the most tuned singers I've ever heard in my life. And number two, she was all there. It was brain and soul and movement at the same time. And she would come in and she would just light up whatever it was that she was involved with.
On stage, Celia Cruz was impossible to miss, often dressed in sparkly dresses, wearing these colorful and towering wigs and platform heels. In 1984, at a show in Barcelona, Spain, she danced with such energy that the crowd, mostly Europeans, joined her in singing Bemba Colorá, or Colorful Mouth.
No, pero eso está muy flojito. Si dice, oye, a ver, bien fuerte, mientras más fuerte.
was the sound of Cuba, embraced by the world. But offstage, Celia Cruz was anything but a diva. That's according to Omer Pardillo, who managed her for over a decade and now oversees her legacy. He remembers the woman behind the legend.
Detrás de esa persona, del icono artista que todos conocen, había una mujer muy diferente, una mujer muy callada.
In her everyday life, Pardilla says, Celia was quiet, humble, and she used to say, I am the party, so when I'm not working, I don't need another one. Pardilla says Celia Cruz gave everything to her music, heart, soul, and discipline.
Es que fue una mujer tan adelantada musicalmente primero.
She was ahead of her time, Pardilla says, in music, in fashion, and always looking for ways to connect with younger generations. That's how she ended up collaborating with unlikely artists, like Argentina's rock band, The Fabulous Cadillacs. Her sound kept evolving, but one thing never changed. Her signature expression. Azúcar, sugar, a word that came to define her. In Boston, radio host José Mazó, who met her several times, says that single word summed up her spirit.
The word captured everything, right? For her, it was like sugar meaning sweet. And for her, overcoming the fact that she had to leave her homeland, that she came to the United States, started all over again, but was able to find success. All of that meant for her that at the end of the day, life was very sweet.
Celia Cruz spent more than 40 years away from Cuba, unable to return even when her mother died. That's for speaking out against Fidel Castro's regime. She dedicated many songs to the homeland she could never see again. Here's one of them. Por si acaso no regreso, yo me llevo tu bandera, lamentando que mis ojos liberada no. In case I never return, I'll take your flag with me, lamenting that my eyes could not see you free. For scholar Frances Aparicio, that exile shaped not only Celia Cruz's music, but her identity.
At some point later, she goes to Guantanamo. She's invited to go to Guantanamo Bay, the U.S. military base, and she picks up some grounds, like soil, and puts it in a little bag, and she takes that with her, and she says, I hope that, you know, when I die, I want to be buried with this soil in my coffin.
Aparicio says that resilience gave Celia's music emotional power.
It also remits us to a form of resisting through joy. And I think dancing and music create spaces for all Latinos and Latinas in the United States to celebrate life together. And I think in the current political moment that we're living, that would be an amazing form of resisting.
Around the world this week, fans are remembering Celia Cruz with concerts, dance parties, and museum tributes. In Miami, a new symphonic show called Celia Sinfonico brings her greatest hits to life. And earlier this year, the U.S. Mint released a quarter with her smiley face. She became the first Afro-Latina ever featured on American currency. But in Cuba, this anniversary has passed quietly. Without official events or tributes, only a small Catholic mass was allowed to remember her. In Cuba, it's been forbidden to play Celia Cruz on the radio, says Barbara Zamora, a Cuban singer now touring the U.S. in a music show where she portrays Celia. Growing up in Havana, Zamora says she had to discover Celia Cruz in secret. Her music reached us through friends, Zamora says, who would travel abroad and bring home vinyl records and cassettes. She says she's certain every Cuban on the island is celebrating Celia Cruz this week, if only in silence. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.